Hey everyone, I'm Ashley Banfield. This is Drop Dead Serious. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for subscribing if you already have. If you haven't, doink, doink. It's free, it's fun, and it really does me a big solid, and thank you for doing so. Big news today. And I feel like I say that a lot, but when we reach a point like we reach today in the Lindsay Clancy trial, it's like a nail biter, right? Because it's all over but the jury. It's officially now in the hands of people Lindsay Clancy never knew before and probably won't know after this. 12 jurors of her peers, people from her community who got their summons and showed up for court and thought, oh dear, I didn't know it was going to be this. And they've sat through it for weeks. And the last thing they had to sit through before they all sit together alone in a room and decide the fate of a woman that heretofore they never knew, was hear the last words from the lawyers, the closing arguments. Before these jurors actually went into the room to start deliberating, Judge Sullivan explained exactly what these 12 jurors now have to decide. For each of Lindsay Clancy's three children, for each one, the jury has five options. It's like, whatever they're going to do, they're probably going to do it three times, right? Because it's all one event, right? Not guilty? That's not going to happen. Not guilty because Lindsay lacked criminal responsibility. Same thing as not guilty by reason of insanity. That's a possibility. Manslaughter? Ah! And that was new. That came about during the charging conference yesterday. And that gives the jury a lot to work with. Okay, let me explain something. They also have the option for second-degree murder, and then, of course, you know, first-degree intentional murder, premeditated, the worst of the worst. But let me just give you the difference between the manslaughter and the second degree, because they're kind of the same, right? They both require sort of this intentional killing, but the second degree has to have malice. The manslaughter is sort of without the malice. So that gives a jury a lot to work with, right? Because, you know, they could have decided between first degree intentional murder, the top charge. It doesn't get any worse than that. Or, oh, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. It's different wording in Massachusetts, but effectively the same thing. And so many juries think, not guilty, I'm not doing that. But the judge did something in this case that would really help them do that. In the jury instructions, and this doesn't happen all the time, trust me, it just doesn't. He really made it clear to this jury that if you vote not guilty, not responsible by reason of insanity, it doesn't mean she's going to walk out the back door and, you know, get an ice cream, hit McDonald's, and then get on Match.com. It doesn't mean that. It means, and he explained this, she'll go to a hospital and she won't get out unless she's evaluated and a panel agrees. Like, he made it really clear to this jury that not guilty by reason of insanity would be acceptable to them. They wouldn't freak out that they were giving her a pass. But now they have this other option, manslaughter too. And of course, second degree. So, this is a tough one for them. A lot to talk about and a lot to think about. First degree murder would mean life, no parole. That's it. Second degree murder means life with the possibility of parole. And manslaughter would carry up to 20 years. So, I mean, she could still have quite a life. Maybe not kids, but, you know, after 20 years. And she could get out earlier. And if Lindsay Clancy is found not guilty by reason of insanity, not criminally responsible, then, of course, she would be committed to a psychiatric hospital right away and potentially for the rest of her life. Though the judge also explained that she could eventually be let go if the doctors decide she's okay. She doesn't need to be hospitalized. She's no longer a danger to herself or others. And what if she is deemed okay in like 5 years? She's young enough to have more kids. What if postpartum takes over again? That's really taxing on a juror. Right? The stakes are really high for a juror to think, but what if we give this pass and then she does it again? And the legal question at the center of all of this is actually pretty specific. Commonwealth has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Lindsay was criminally responsible when she killed Cora and Dawson and Callan. If the jurors believe that she was indeed suffering from a mental disease or defect, they have to decide whether that condition, left her unable to appreciate what she was doing was wrong. Doesn't know right from wrong. And unable to control her actions according to the law. And it's so important, the message the jury hears. And of course, what the jury hears, the rest of the courtroom hears too, right? And so I have two guests coming up who have followed this meticulously. And they have different opinions about what might happen when this jury goes in to deliberate and makes its decision. So do not go anywhere until you hear both of them. Importantly, Judge Sullivan told them that mental disease or defect does not have to fit neatly into some formal medical diagnosis. That, I say that's the whole ball of wax for me. It's a big deal because for weeks and weeks, these lawyers and these experts have been fighting over postpartum psychosis and whether she was or not in a fit of postpartum psychosis. No, she was just in postpartum depression. No, she was in postpartum psychosis, which gets you to the level of I did not know right from wrong. I couldn't appreciate, I couldn't comport my actions with the law. But now the judge is giving them that latitude, right? Mental disease or defect does not have to fit neatly into some formal medical diagnosis. So Kevin Reddington stood up and argued in closings for Lindsay Clancy. That's her lawyer. And he started with the kids, Cora, Dawson, and Callan. Smart move. Smart move for a defense attorney to start with the kids, because this is all about the kids, right? Let me read you what he said. They are the victims of the horrible, horrific act that has been laid at your feet as jurors to decide whether or not Lindsay is guilty. And then he held up two pictures. One showed the Clancy family before January 24th, 2023, and the other picture showed the aftermath. And he asked the jury essentially, how did this family get from there to here? And his answer was blunt. Because of the damn medicine and the lousy medical care that she got, end quote. That was really the heart of the defense closing. Kevin Reddington told the jury that right before Lindsay's mental health started deteriorating, she had basically done everything right. This young lady, he said, did nothing wrong in her life. She was a nurse, a daughter, a wife, and a darn good mother, end quote. He showed family pictures and Facebook posts, including Lindsay smiling with Dawson. And remember, prosecutors have suggested that there may have been significance to Dawson being killed first, the middle child. Kevin Reddington called that idea repulsive. Quote, they would have you think she killed him first cruelly because she didn't like him. That is repulsive, end quote. While he was talking, Lindsay was crying and wiping her eyes. And then came something I have not seen in closings. And I've seen my fair share of drama. Like, I've seen my fair share of objections during closings. That's nuts. Like, objections during closings and openings is nuts. You don't want that because it makes you look like the bad guy in front of the jury. If there's objection after objection after objection, it is not a good look. And yet Kevin Reddington did something that I think would elicit an objection. Quarters, as in like, you know, 25 cents. So he slaps one quarter down on the table while he begins talking about Lindsay's suicide attempt. And he used that quarter to highlight a challenge. He's challenging prosecutors to explain away all of the testimony about how serious or not serious Lindsay's suicide attempt was. And then Judge Sullivan actually like put some brakes on had to remind him, you really shouldn't be doing that. The judge said, counsel, address the jury.
That's a quarter. don't know if you ever played pool. I challenge you to tell this jury why we spent a week showing that she committed, your witnesses.
Counsel, address the jury, please.
Said their witnesses. Serious suicide attempt. Remember that? Tried to kill herself. So now they'll back off on that, and they'll agree. A serious suicide attempt. That's why I say, watch the evidence. Watch the manipulation.
But Kevin Reddington's point was that the Commonwealth has tried to minimize Lindsay's attempt to take her own life. It was shallow, and she didn't really mean to do it. And Kevin Reddington wanted to remind the jury that the pills, the cuts, the fall from the second story, the paralysis, it all means something. Like, it means she meant it. Who would do this? Who would do all those things if you were just trying to make it look? And then he asked them to think about what was happening inside Lindsay's mind as she lay in the hospital. He said, quote, what kind of demons, what kind of horror was in her mind as she lay there paralyzed, end quote. From there, Kevin Reddington went right back to the expert testimony, and he reminded the jurors that Dr. Philip Resnick concluded, as a doctor, that Lindsay was psychotic when she killed all three of her own kids. Cut and dry, he said. This doctor said it. And Kevin Reddington argued that the Commonwealth's experts never completely eliminated that possibility. Okay, that's important, because remember the reasonable doubt? When you're talking about reasonable doubt, might one of those jurors say, but hold on, Commonwealth never said that's impossible. So is it reasonable to think that it's quite possible? It's the reasonable quotient, right? Lindsay's lawyer pointed specifically to testimony from the prosecution expert, the one named Kirk Halbrun, and he told the jury that even if the Commonwealth's witness leaves room for more than one explanation, quote, that is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. He took the words right out of my mouth. Kevin Reddington also went after the prosecution for what he repeatedly called manipulation. And he told the jurors to, quote, watch the manipulation, accusing counsel on the other side, accusing those prosecutors of making ordinary details sound sinister and then exaggerating parts of Lindsay's life to fit their narrative and fit their theory. And by the way, welcome to court. That is what you do. That is what prosecutors do. And it is what defense attorneys do. They take all the facts and evidence and they mold it into their story. It's the way it works. But, you know, jurors are kind of in there for the first time, so. And then another quarter went down on the table. And then another one after that. And by the third quarter, Kevin Reddington was calling the manipulation, the alleged manipulation by the prosecutors, he was calling it, quote, unquote, disgusting.
Disgusting.
And because this trial has no shortage of unusual courtroom moments, he also brought up, are you ready? Pour yourself something. The Shining. The movie, The Shining. He compared Lindsay's handwritten journals where she tracked medications and documented what she was feeling to that famous scene in The Shining when Jack Nicholson's character is supposedly writing a book.
And when you consider the journals, I don't know, you ever watched the movie there, The Shining, with Jack Nicholson. Remember the scene when he's sitting there in a state of complete psychosis and he's writing a book and he's typing and the wife finds the book and opens it up and looks at it and says, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Repeated after repeated after repeated. And he says, do you like it? You look at the records of her Googling drugs. You look at how many times, how many hours of the night in the afternoon she's looking this stuff up, in between taking care of the family, in between all of the stuff that was going on with visiting doctors, seeing doctors, going to Rhode Island, being told, no, we can't help you, calling a suicide hotline, we can't help you, calling another suicide hotline, we can't help you. My God, what does she have to do? She was reaching out for help, and she was not getting it.
Kevin Reddington's point was that Lindsay's writing showed a mind unraveling. And then it was time for the prosecutors. It was their turn. And for the prosecutors, Jennifer Sprague delivered the closings. So she stood up and she started by conceding two things immediately. And that's great. Honest to God, whenever you concede something, it always makes the jury feel like you're not trying to snow them or thou dost protest too much. Like, it's really good when lawyers say, I got you, my bad on that one, or I'll give you that, because it just makes you more human, more believable, more real. Here's what she said. There's no dispute that Lindsay Clancy was suffering from mental illness and that she tried to kill herself. There's no dispute about that. But Jennifer Sprague said, that's not enough. This is the heart of their case, right? We know something's wrong with her. Look, we all know. But what they say is wrong with her isn't true. And what we're saying is wrong with her isn't enough to give her that pass of not guilty by reason of insanity. Commonwealth's position is that Lindsay may have been mentally ill, but she still knew right from wrong. That's the key. That's the whole ball of wax. Right? Attorney Sprague pushed back hard on the defense claim that Lindsay had been failed by the medical system. She reminded the jurors that Lindsay had health insurance and multiple doctors, specialty mental health programs, and support from family, 18 weeks of maternity leave, and a nanny helping at home. That's more than most of us, right? And then Jennifer Sprague went back to those 13 medications that we heard so much about during this trial. And her point was that just because a medication had been prescribed did not mean that Lindsay was actually taking it. Some bottles had few, maybe no pills missing. So sure, you can talk about 13, but did she actually take 13? Because the having them isn't the effect. The taking them is the effect. And then Jennifer Sprague got to something that prosecutors believe is really critical here. Lindsay told her husband, Patrick Clancy, and told her mother that she had thoughts of harming herself and the children. But this prosecutor said that she did not tell the healthcare providers who were treating her. And prosecutors say that shows that Lindsay understood those thoughts were wrong. Quote, you know that she knew the difference between right and wrong during that time. That's a rational thought. She knew it was wrong. She was even more direct about what Lindsay told her doctors. She lied to them, quote unquote. She lied to them, the prosecutor said. And she reminded the jurors that right up through January 23rd, Lindsay was denying a suicide plan, denying thoughts of hurting anyone else, denying voices, denying hallucinations. And her providers were not seeing signs of psychosis. We can argue about those providers, and I have in other episodes. Some of them just saw her by Zoom. Okay, like, Zoom is good. Okay, right, great. I'm coming to you via video too, but you can't see me tapping my feet down below. You can't tell what I'm wearing down below. And you know what? Body language can mean a lot. Body language can mean a lot. And telehealth and a nurse practitioner isn't the same as being in your psychiatrist's office day after day after day. You also communicate a little more differently when you're just on video. But think about it, guys. How many Zoom calls have you had? And you're not always totally yourself. You're performing because you're on video. You're on camera. So it's a little different than just being in the room with someone. Then Jennifer Sprague got to the actual date of January 24th. And I have to say, the date is all that matters here. The way it works is that your mind on that day, in those moments, the window where the killings happened, that is the only moment that this jury has to consider in terms of was she sane or not. It doesn't matter about the days leading up. She can lie all she wants to everybody in the days leading up because experts have said over and over again on this podcast, elsewhere, in the courtroom, listen, look it up. You can come in and out of psychosis, okay? You can come in and out of bouts of different levels of mental health and crises. You can be out of it on the day that you're talking to your nurse practitioner or your psychiatrist, and you are not telling them that you're hearing voices to kill your kids. and then you are in the moments that you do it. That is a key question. That's really what this jury should be considering. And this is where the Commonwealth says the evidence just looks like planning. Jennifer Sprague said that Lindsay searched for Miralax for the kids. She looked up the restaurant where Patrick would pick up dinner. She checked how long the trip would take, and then came CVS. The prosecutor argued that Lindsay added another stop so that she could make the window longer, give herself more time for killing. And she even called CVS ahead of time to make sure the medication that she wanted was in stock. Because if it wasn't there, Patrick might come home early. Jennifer Sprague, the prosecutor on this case, called that planning, that thinking, and that decision-making important. Planning, thinking, decision-making. From someone who's in psychosis, really postpartum psychosis, and you can get all that done? And that brought Jennifer Sprague, the prosecutor, to one of the biggest fights in this case. The timing of Patrick's phone call while he's standing inside the CVS. The defense says that Lindsay heard the voice telling her to kill the kids after the phone call with her husband. Prosecution says that timeline doesn't make any sense, though, because Jennifer Sprague, the prosecutor, said that there wasn't enough time after the phone call for Lindsay to kill all three kids and then do her suicide attempt. Not enough time between the phone call at CVS and the ultimate acts and the completion of the acts. She argued that if Lindsay had already been controlled by a voice before the phone call, Jennifer Sprague asked, well, how could she stop, notice Patrick had called, call him back, have a conversation, and then continue the killing? It's important. Here's what she said.
Because if she's already killed the kids because of a voice and being compelled and it being against her will and she's like a puppet, then she can't get a call and miss it and then call the person back and have a conversation and then hang up. A puppet can't do those things. Those are decisions and choices and actions that she's controlling.
These are things Lindsay Clancy is in control of. Meaning, how can she be in control of these things and suddenly not be in control of herself so that she can comport with the law? It's a very good argument, because that is the prong that this jury has to consider. Could she control herself and comport with the law? Did she know right from wrong? And then the prosecutor walked right over to that little area where the defense attorney had been throwing the quarters down and started taking the quarters back. Thinking on her feet. Right? She wasn't expecting the quarters. She didn't know those quarters were coming. She had to decide in real time. While she's also nervous about giving her closing argument, trying to get all the facts in, think about where she has to be and when she has to address the jury and when she has to quote. And she's taking into consideration this little curveball that Kevin Reddington threw her by throwing the quarters down. And she took one quarter back while talking about the exercise bands that were used to strangle the kids. The prosecutors say that those bands were not knotted, meaning they had to be physically held and pulled tight. Here's the quote. You have to pull them. And you know they weren't knotted. Patrick never testified that they were knotted. So I'll take this one. End quote. And then she took another quarter while talking about Lindsay's suicide attempt. And Jennifer Sprague said the details matter and that the pills were not taken in lethal quantities. The cuts were superficial, and Lindsay survived her fall. So prosecutors want the jury to ask themselves this. If some voice was powerful enough to compel Lindsay to successfully kill all three of her kids, why wasn't it powerful enough to make her successfully kill herself? And then in another really strong move, the prosecutors did something else. And let me back up a little bit, because Lindsay's lawyer had accused them of accusing their medical expert, right? Of accusing Lindsay's own medical expert of helping Lindsay invent a voice, right? And so that's a lot of accusations. And the prosecutor stood up and went and took another quarter and said, we never said that. We never said that he told the defendant what to say. Not one witness, not one piece of evidence. So basically saying, we don't know what the heck Kevin Reddington was saying about this, but we didn't make that accusation about the defense's own medical expert, that he was somehow telling Lindsay to invent a voice. You'll get covered this way. Well, now I'm kind of lost, and I kind of feel like the jurors will say, yeah, I don't get that either. Let's throw the whole thing out. Which helps, right? Because if you have a fact that's uncomfortable and you cause a lot of confusion around it, a lot of times jurors will just say, I don't get it, so out it goes. And then you're left with the reasonable doubt with everything else. So then the Commonwealth finally answered the question that has been hanging over this case from the very beginning. If Lindsay was not psychotic, why the fuck would she kill three of her kids that she loved dearly? And the Commonwealth's answer is incredibly dark. The prosecutor, Jennifer Sprague, said that the children were Lindsay's protective factor. They were the reason that she had not killed herself. According to prosecutors, Lindsay wanted to die. But Lindsay believed that she just couldn't leave those kids behind. If I can't be here with them, nobody can. That's effectively what she's saying. Lindsay herself wanted out. But she just figured, the kids better come with me because they shouldn't be here by themselves. That's a crime. Yeah, and we've seen it a lot. And the prosecutor acknowledged that most of us do not want to believe that a mother could make a choice like that. Here's how she said it. It is a choice that we don't want to think about that a mother could make because that doesn't make us feel safe or comfortable in this world. But it's a choice she made. And then she turned to the first degree murder charge and the question of extreme atrocity or cruelty. Attorney Sprague asked the jury to think about what Cora and Dawson and Callan went through.
Just think of that. The being strangled and the pain and the confusion that they're going through, and it's being done by their mom. Their mom is the one that's hurting them. Their mom is the one that's killing them. She killed them, and she left them there on the floor with the bands around their necks. She didn't bring them up to their beds and put them with their favorite stuffed animal and cover them up gently and lovingly, leaving them peacefully there. No. She left them discarded on the basement floor like broken toys because she was done playing the game.
And her final words to the jury, quote, you know, to a moral certainty, she's guilty. Okay. Wow. Wow. You know, to a moral certainty? Well, what's reasonable? What's moral? Some people's morals are nowhere near the same as other people's morals. Some people don't think it's moral to drink. And you know me, I'm like, pour yourself a drink for this fact. Some people think it's immoral to drink. So the level of how reasonable you are, this prosecutor now wants you to be at the level of morality. But we all have different morals. You know, some of us think it's fine to have a drink. Others are like, you should never, ever have a drink. Every one of us thinks you shouldn't kill. But saying to a moral certainty she's guilty, well, that is not the same as reasonable doubt under criminal code. Not at all. Morals don't come into it. Morals shouldn't take any part of their headspace. It's the evidence and reasonable doubt. But look at that prosecutor leaving them with that, you know, to a moral certainty. Because that's all this prosecutor can say. Moral certainty, according to this prosecutor's morals and maybe other people's morals. But this prosecutor can't say, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt she's guilty. Because there's still some question there. There really is. And now 9 women and 3 men have to decide whether she's right, whether the Commonwealth proved it. And there's no one in there to help them. No, this is what's so incredible about jury deliberations. And jurors themselves feel the weight of it and the loneliness of it. Once it's all over and those jury instructions are done and those closings are done and they are led into that deliberation room, the door closes and it's just them. And up until that time, they are not to have spoken about this yet. Like, they've sat through all of this, and every time they're brought out, they're reminded, you are not to speak amongst yourselves about this. You do not discuss this until the very end, and now we're there. So now it's the first time they're like, hey, so what do you think? Oh, what do you think? It's really crazy. They've been together all these weeks and they've never been allowed to talk about the one thing that brought them there. And the one thing they've been sitting through every day, they've not been allowed to discuss it. And now they can. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. It is almost invariable. Most juries instantly say, well, I guess it's just us now. I guess we need to pick a foreman. And should we just go around the horn and see what y'all think? Yes or no? Guilty or not guilty? Or what are your thoughts? And they often do that. And even if they come to a unanimous decision right there and then, guilty or not guilty, whatever, they still deliberate. They still say, okay, well, we need to discuss. We need to go over the evidence. We need to make sure we didn't screw up. I know we all think that right now, but we really haven't done our jobs. And so they will often start methodically going through the evidence, whether they took notes or whatever, you know, exhibits were brought back into the deliberation room. Sometimes there are exhibits, sometimes there aren't. Sometimes they're allowed to see testimony, have things reread. Sometimes they're not allowed. And again, usually one of the first questions that comes from a deliberating jury is, Your Honor, can you please define what reasonable doubt is? And they're told it's what's inside you. Is it a doubt that you can accept, or it's a doubt you can't accept? And everybody's different. So that's what they're doing. They're in there. And I always say, oh, to be a fly on the wall. And every lawyer wants to be a fly on the wall. And they often ask jurors after, tell us how you got there. Tell us what you think. Because it just informs how we do our jobs, how we learn about juries, how we learn about deliberations, how we learn about our own performance. You know, it's amazing. It's really fascinating. And that's what they're doing now. And don't ask me how fast I think they'll come up with a verdict, because everybody's different. So to help me sort through how these closings landed, because honest to God, unless you are there and seeing everything, it certainly can feel different in print. It certainly can feel different on a podcast. But the lawyers who see it, they see things differently. They see where huge points are made and they see where huge points are lost. And for that, I called upon one of the better ones, Sarah Azari. She's a criminal defense attorney. She's been through a trial or two and she knows her stuff, and she had a lot to say about these closings and this case. Here's our conversation. Sarah Azari, thank you so much for being on Drop Dead Serious.
Of course. Good to see you.
Okay, talk to me, girl. Being in a courtroom is entirely different than reading transcripts or seeing headlines. When you hear those final closings, you're left with the, I always call it the heavy air. Tell me about the heavy air in that courtroom.
Well, I mean, look, Ashley, I think ultimately this is going to turn on whether this jury is going to go with the psychiatric testimony and sort of the, you know, the humanity, which is on the defense side, or the law, which I think is on the state side. And interestingly, in Massachusetts, the prosecution goes after the defense for closing. And they spent a lot of time on the idea that the bodies were left in the basement like toys, you know, and this image. I mean, there was this focus on this image that the jury was left with at the end. And to me, I mean, that could cut both ways, right? It could be, are they referring to the bodies of the three children as toys, which was devastating to the defense? Or is that some sort of a reference to her, in which case I think it could backfire on the state. So that to me was interesting, because the whole focus was on that image for a long time.
Well, and I think if you refer to them as toys and she's finished playing the game, you're right, it could cut both ways. But I actually personally found it a little offensive. I just sort of thought, let's not play word games with three dead children at this point. Let's just call it what it is and just focus on the fact that you're saying she wasn't psychotic and they're saying she was.
Yeah, and Reddington, you know, what he did really well is that he started the closing with there are three victims here and these are the children. And that was important because that's something that, you know, it gave him permission to get into this whole thing of the psychiatric testimony, you know, and her state of mind, as opposed to just going into that. So he just, you know, got that out of the way as opposed to letting the prosecution go there. So to your point, I think, you know, he did handle the idea, the identity of who the victims are, and then went into what the defense is, which was effective, in my opinion.
I feel like one episode of this podcast I did with an expert who has worked in postpartum psychiatric issues, and it's a rainbow. It's a very large spectrum of different issues that she's dealt with in her practice. And I felt like I understood it all. Like, I really felt like that was the one tutelage that I needed to get through this case. And I wonder if you feel like the dueling experts did anybody any justice in this courtroom when it comes to the issues at play.
You know, it's interesting you brought that up because at the beginning, and I've had experience with you know, psychosis as a defense. I mean, there's drug psychosis, there's different kinds of psychosis, but I've never had a postpartum case. And at the beginning, I thought of this as a sort of run-of-the-mill, you know, battle of the experts. And I realized it's really not, because this area is so, it's a real thing, but it's a rare thing. And so when you're weighing as a juror the credibility of an expert, and you're looking at, okay, who has more experience with this? Who has had more cases? You're kind of left with, they're kind of on equal footing. Like, it's just not a very common thing. And so they can't really look at these experts and be like, well, this guy really knows a lot about this because he's got like 20 cases, you know? So it's interesting. I don't know how they're going to view, you know, the expert testimony. And also, just as a general rule, when it gets too science-y for a jury, they just tend to chuck it, you know?
Yeah. And it's a lot. I mean, ask the OJ jurors if they understand DNA after 9 months, and they didn't.
Exactly. And the easy thing is to then go with just the reasonableness, you know, or just the common sense, right? That's a mother that, you know, obviously cared about her children, loved her children, would do this from a sane mind. I mean, you know, it might just boil down to that, the basic question.
Yeah. You know, I keep coming back to a lot of these kinds of cases come back to Andrea Yates for me, because that was like the grandmother of all of these postpartum cases. But I really feel like if they had a case in front of them, Sarah, where a mom was abusive to her children, hated being a mom, was exhausted, frustrated, drinking, whatever, that gave you a practical motive for wanting out of all of it. All you all and everything. I think it would be easier to say, yeah, this is easy to say guilty of first or second, maybe not even manslaughter, but I think everything else just shows there just doesn't seem to be a reasonable answer for this other than the one they gave us that we rarely hear about, which is not guilty because she wasn't reasonably responsible for this.
Yeah, and I think a big win for the defense was getting that instruction on a manslaughter. I mean, to me, like to many, this is really not criminally responsible. That's the verdict here. But it at least gives the jury a place to land if they're struggling with the idea of, you know, a full acquittal on not being criminally responsible. So, I mean, that was a big win for the defense.
It's so funny you should say that, because there was one point when the jury instructions were happening and manslaughter, you know, came into play. I thought, wait a minute. Hold it. Does the defense want that? Because it definitely gives the jury something bigger and uglier than the verdict they'd like, which is she's going to a hospital, she's going to get the care, and one day she might get out and live a productive life. This would take you into prison for up to 20 years. But you're saying that the shot of getting the not guilty, which is so rare, is so scary. At least let's get her that.
Yeah, at least she has that, which is far better than second degree murder. And I also think, you know, in you know, the running the risk of a hung jury, and something like this will get retried, you know. So it's more of a definitive closure to the case for something that she can live with. And to your point about, you know, her not walking out of the courtroom and being committed to a mental hospital, I mean, the chances of her one day going home is not great. I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't know what her future progress reports are going to look like. But generally, people who get committed, the DA every year on the dot will come back to court, make a case for why she's not well. And, you know, even if the hospital, you know, supervising doctor says she's fine, ultimately the decision is up to the court. And rarely do they just get to walk after a few years. So, it is kind of a life commitment, practically speaking.
Super interesting you said that, because I have actually had other guests who have confused me, where I've said, wait, it's just up to the doctors? Do they notify the DA? Like, where's the communication? But you're saying the doctors are the ones who say, hey, she's clear for takeoff, and the DA can say, too bad.
The DA can object to takeoff, and then ultimately the court decides about takeoff. And so they can absolutely override the medical finding. They can ask for an independent medical evaluation to see whether there's agreement between the experts. I mean, she's got a tough road ahead of her. It's not like she's going to go home anytime soon. And so when you compare that to a manslaughter conviction, it could very well be a shorter prison term, you know. But I mean, the ultimate thing is that even if she goes to prison, she has to get the care she needs, because obviously she's not well.
Yeah, but you won't, right? Like, in a state penitentiary, they've got wards, but it's never the same as a hospital with all of the assets and services that the hospitals have. So if she goes to prison, I think, can't we all sort of agree she's going to be damaged goods when she gets out?
Yeah, you're not going to get the same care. Yeah, no, for sure, you're not going to get the same care. But I mean, she would be in a mental ward of the prison, and to some degree, she's going to get some care. But I was just thinking of what, you know, this jury has such a fat menu of options. You know, they have, because now they have manslaughter as well, but they have first degree, second degree, manslaughter, not guilty at all, which is obviously unlikely, but and then they also have not criminally responsible. And I was trying to read the tea leaves, but I want to hear what your tea leaves are first.
Well, honestly, I've gone back and forth, and I keep coming back to the fact that I just wish I'd been looking at all of the potential jurors during voir dire. I feel like this one is going to be decided in jury selection. The arguments all seemed cogent to me. They all made perfect sense. They were diametrically opposed, which is frustrating. The experts, I feel, you're right, kind of cancel each other out, unless somebody smelled a rat. You know, like if the jurors felt like one of these experts, that whole thing about, were you paid to be here, might have landed with some jurors and not others. I don't know. But I really feel like if the jury got the same tutelage that I did about coming in and out of psychosis, meaning I can be perfectly lucid in 10 minutes prior to being in a psychosis in the 18 minutes when I'm killing the kids, and then out of that psychosis and into it and out of it, then I think that they could render the not guilty, I say by reason of insanity, it just makes more sense, but not responsible in Massachusetts. But listen, I've been at this game a long time, and so have you, and I can think through a lot of these options under legal code. I don't think that jurors can. I think they're going with the narratives. What narrative did I get? Which person do I believe more? And then that, I couldn't tell you.
Well, and, you know, to your point, like, I think that that component of the fleeting nature of psychosis and how you can have a perfectly normal day and then have this break for a short period of time and then continue to have a normal day. That was the most valuable part of the expert testimony to me, you know, because that's something that many people don't know and don't understand and can't grasp, you know, how that can be. So to me, that's the idea, is like, do they get it, you know, and do they buy it? And But I also think that, you know, the sympathy aspect of this is like this woman clearly, genuinely wanted to take her life and failed at, you know, committing suicide. And that wheelchair is the star witness that didn't testify. It's like she didn't take the stand, yeah. but it's like her wheelchair did, you know? And yeah. And I just, you know, we can't underestimate that because I think jurors sat there for 5 weeks looking at her, not just breaking down every so often, which was also genuine, but sitting in that wheelchair. I mean, that's powerful stuff. It's not just the evidence. You know,
and you're absolutely right. The wheelchair was so critical as I don't want to say a prop because it wasn't a prop, but it was a witness. You're right. Other than that, she looked great. And I think that's problematic. You almost want to see somebody catatonic or drooling or something in order to get you to insanity. And even then I've sat through cases where somebody was drooling and that it didn't prevail. Can I ask you about a decision that a defense attorney would have to make with a client like this about mm-hmm. putting her on the stand? What mm-hmm. metrics are you going through in your head about whether or not to let people hear from her herself?
Well, I think the main issue that I would have is number one, in any case where I'm deciding whether to put the client on the stand is whether do I absolutely need to? I mean, is there something that I need the jury to hear that I can't get in otherwise? And this was not a case where she could have added anything to the mix. But my concern would be that even if she's obviously an educated woman, she clearly loved her children. I'm sure she would break down on the stand. All of that is great. But the idea that, like you said, she looked good and she was sitting there, which is the case with almost all of these sort of psychosis or mental health cases, because if she wasn't, she wouldn't be competent. She wouldn't be able to go forward with trial.
Right.
But my concern would be that once she opens her mouth and she's completely coherent and sophisticated in the way that she speaks, I mean, that would just complicate things, because then it's harder for the jury to divorce who she is today from that fleeting, you know, window of psychosis, you know?
Do you think in that respect that that Kevin Reddington was able to impart in close, because I think closings are critical. We forget so much and our notes are only so good, but closings are closings when you walk through that deliberation door. Do you think he was able to impart on this jury in closings that it can be fleeting? So the woman you're seeing across the way right there is not the woman who was in that basement with those kids.
I think he could have hammered it a little bit more in the way that you just put it. But I think he did a really good job at connecting the dots for the jury about how she was failed by the system, how she had tried desperately to get help and couldn't, and, you know, that the system failed her, that she progressively got worse. I think the problem that, you know, that there were two issues that I think were not good for the defense and made the closings for the prosecution strong is, one, the focus on atrocity and cruelty as an alternative theory to the premeditation that gets you to first degree. So in Massachusetts, you can be convicted of first degree murder if you premeditated and planned the murder, or if there was atrocity and cruelty involved. And so they used the time that it took to strangle and kill and make sure they were dead, each of these kids, with the exercise band. And that's kind of problematic because it's just a lot of time, you know, and you have opportunity to stop and you don't. So that I thought was bad for the defense. And I'm not sure how he could have, you know, really combated that, although he did do a fairly good job at explaining that all of it was part of that psychotic episode. Like, she was not of sane mind at the time when she was doing this. And I think the other issue was just generally that, you know, the law, I think, is stronger for the prosecution, but the facts, I think, are problematic for the prosecution. And the idea that the prosecution said, for example, that she had told her husband and her mother about these thoughts, but didn't tell the healthcare providers. And that was sort of her non-disclosure was sort of planned, you know.
Well, it was tantamount to saying, I know right from wrong. I don't want them to
know this
stuff.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And I'm not sure. I think the defense could have done a better job at explaining that. But again,
you know what, Sarah? I've been thinking about that. And I wonder if, again, this is all before the fact, right? In the days leading up to this. So again, it doesn't count what happened in those days leading up, because the episode and whether you're psychotic in the episode is what counts. So let's just say I know right from wrong when I'm talking to the medical professional and I'm embarrassed. I don't want to say that I want to kill my kids because, my God, they're going to arrest me. They're going to take my kids away. I don't want that. And then in the episode, in the moment, she's being commanded and believes it's right. So again, two things can be true at the same time.
Exactly. Two things can be. There was a lot of two things can be true in this trial, you know. And I think the idea that she doesn't want her kids taken away, especially because there's evidence that she's a loving mother. I mean, that's consistent, you know. So it's a very interesting case, and almost identical to Andrea Yates. And I believe that the expert in Andrea Yates, who now has an expert service that, you know, basically he hires other experts. Basically, one of the experts in this case was his employer or something like. There's a connection there with the experts between Park Dietz, this is his name, Park Dietz, and then the expert, one of the experts in this case, but for the state.
But wasn't Park Dietz the one that said it was a Law and Order episode? And it turned out, oh, that episode had not yet aired at the time that Andrea killed her kids. So nice try, but let's have a retrial.
Exactly. Yeah, that was actually why it was overturned, but or a main factor in that. But yeah, I mean, this to me, and you know, and then I was thinking about, you know, is this, how long will the jury deliberate? You know, those things that we talk about after, after a case goes to the jury. And it's interesting because typically we say when the case goes to the jury close to the weekend or around the holiday, or just in general, if it's a quick verdict, it means guilty. In this case, I think if this is a quick verdict, it's going to be not criminally responsible. You know, it's kind of ironic to me. I think
you and Bob Ward feel differently. You and Bob Ward feel differently. He thinks quick verdict means she's getting the hammer, and you think quick verdict means they've gone with Kevin Reddington.
Well, I think quick verdict generally means the defendant's getting the hammer. In this case, I think a quick verdict would mean she's not criminally responsible. But I don't expect a quick verdict. I expect the deliberations will go at least into next week. Hopefully through next week, because these are some complicated facts that the jury's been sitting through for 5 weeks, and that you have to believe that there's at least one juror who's going to buy and understand the expert testimony about psychosis and understand that this was psychosis and say, no, I am not going to be convinced just because three kids, as sad as and tragic as it is, were killed by their mother, that she's guilty of some sort of homicide. Like, one juror at least should have the backbone to say, no, this woman had a break, you know? And
or
this is
so a murder. She's definitely guilty of a homicide. She's a person who killed a person, but the intent behind it, you're right. And I wonder, since you said that, I wonder, I'm rethinking it now. I think that there's much bigger potential for a hung jury, because unless that person you're saying understood, that if that one person or two of them understood the deep medical implications of a psychosis, would they be persuasive enough to teach the others? And that's not always possible.
And remember that Massachusetts is different and really more defense friendly in this regard when it comes to insanity. It's that the burden is not on the defense to prove insanity. The burden is on the prosecution to prove sanity beyond a reasonable doubt once the defense is raised. So, you know, I don't think the prosecution has met its burden here.
I can't wait to talk to you when we get a verdict. Will you come back?
Yeah, let's do it.
Oh, Sarah Azari, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for this
time. Great seeing you, Ashley. Congratulations on the podcast.
Thank you so much. So until that time, all we have to go on is how the air hung in that courtroom after everybody was done talking. It's just usually so thick, right? The vibe is like nothing else you've ever experienced. I have this great mentor in my life, Jack Ford. He's a Yale law professor, longtime prosecutor, defense attorney, and also television anchor, commentator, Good Morning America, ABC, and also NBC Today Show. And my God, that guy sat beside me for years and years at Court TV and taught me everything I know about the law. And he often said, trials are like a drama, and they play out very much like a drama, and the emotions can feel very much like a drama. They are like a real live show, pretty much like the very first reality TV, if you think about it. And so when the talking is done and the jury files out to deliberate, it's what was left by everybody in the gallery that's your best sense of what was left with them. And so Bob Ward knows that feeling. He was there. He sat through this trial. He is one of the best correspondents in the business. He's been an investigative correspondent and a journalist for decades. He's covering this case for Boston 25, and he was kind enough in his extraordinarily busy day to chat with me a little bit about how all of this felt when the talking was done. Bob Ward, you're amazing. You're so amazing that literally you're joining us from your vehicle outside the courtroom as things wrap up. I am so appreciative. Let's just get right to it. How did things feel as those closings were happening?
I thought they were pretty intense. You know, it started with the defense, Kevin Reddington, and then followed up by the prosecutor, and they both had totally different approaches to this. Kevin Reddington is challenging all this, not on the facts, but on what was in Lindsey Clancy's head. And he's a very strong advocate for her and for her mental health. And he comes across as taking it very personally of all the efforts that she made to try to get help for herself and how she was turned away. So he kind of has a simmering rage. He's almost always like at a pot of boiling water that's just about to boil over. And that's kind of his style. Kind of a rough and ready way, but he connects very directly with people and with juries. So that's what he was like today. And he just came right out at the very beginning. He had a picture of the Clancy family from the summer of 22 and another picture on the other side. I think it was Lindsey in a hospital bed. And he said, how did we get from this to this? And he said, it was our lousy mental health system. That's how we got here. And it was the lousy drugs. And then he went through kind of took almost a scattershot approach. Like, he attacked so many different aspects of the case. Sometimes it was hard to keep up, to be honest. But the prosecution, on the other hand, took a different approach and put right in front of all of it the three Clancy children and kind of walked the jury through how they believe that Lindsey Clancy decided on her own to take the children as part of her suicide attempt because she couldn't possibly leave them behind. And then coldly and calculatingly took the lives of each one of them. And I thought it was very powerful at the end of that presentation when the prosecutor said, you know, Lindsey Clancy could have left, the kids could have picked them up and put them in their beds and put them with their toys and put them in a place of comfort. But she left them on the floor of the basement like broken toys. And I thought powerful. That was such a powerful image to leave in the jury's mind. So that was what it was like today.
I know you're a reporter. You can't weigh in on, which way do you think this went? But honest to goodness, I just want to know from the person who's so savvy about these cases, who's been in these courtrooms before, did you have a feeling one way leading up to closings and after closings feel something different?
Not really. I think, especially now that there is a room for compromise for the jury, I think that it's very unlikely, I think, that Lindsey Clancy is going to be found not guilty. And I think the mm-hmm. fact that there are compromised verdicts, I think it's less likely that the not guilty by insanity or not criminally responsible is going to work. I think the jury is likely to find some combination of accountability for the children, meaning prison time, and the ability to not spend the rest of her life in prison. It's just a feeling that I have.
And you think the manslaughter then?
It could be manslaughter or murder too. It's one of those. And if it's manslaughter, you know, the thing is, if it's manslaughter, that can be 20. Up to 20 years for each charge. But in Massachusetts, they'll run those concurrent. And it could be significantly less than 20 years. So the only way the jury is, you know, and I don't know if they know this, the only way the jury can guarantee any kind of serious prison time, which I would say is 15 to 20, is if it were second degree, and then she can start petitioning in about 15 to 20 years for parole. And in this state, I think it's safe bet she will be paroled. And I think for a lot of people that are looking at this case, something along those lines is reasonable. But I wouldn't discount the possibility that manslaughter, there may be something in line here with manslaughter. You'll have to look back. Remember the Louise Woodward case up in Cambridge?
Oh, sure.
A long time ago.
Yeah, the shaken baby. Matthew Epen was her victim.
Yeah, and she was convicted, but it was the judge who kind of stole it back from the prosecutors and did the direct verdict. And now she's out, and I think she's a lawyer in the UK. So I just think in Massachusetts, you know, it's a very liberal state, very progressively minded. And it's different, though. That's politics. It's law and order is a different thing. But I do think there's a lot of empathy for Lindsay as a young mother and the situation that she's in. You know, what's happened to her. She's paralyzed. But I'll tell you what, that last statement that the prosecutor made, I like to tell some of the other reporters here as we all talk about it. We almost have like group therapy session in the breaks. And we all are trying to figure out how this is going on. And the one thing that we keep coming back to is there's two things the general public has not seen, and only one of them that we have. And that is the 911 call and the autopsy photos. That 911 call was horrendous. We talked about this last time. And that talk about a powerful piece of evidence. There's no running away from that, because in real time, you're hearing Patrick Clancy discovering his children. So that's number one. We've heard that. We know how powerful it is. But we did not see the autopsy photos, and that was by judge's order. But the jury has, and the jury was crying. They're members of the jury, not all of them. They're members of the jury crying. And, you know, without knowing what those photos look like, it's hard to, you know, how do you get past that? And there's mom sitting over there, granted in a wheelchair. So that's kind of, as we analyze this, it's kind of the, lack of a better phrase, the wild card in the pack. I mean, that's the one thing we don't really know as we try to assess where this might go.
And brilliant for the prosecution to focus on those children, if that is, of course, the evidence that sent them into tears. And I actually did want to ask you whether any of the jurors had any reactions during closings, or was it just perfunctory? They listened, and then they filed out.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, my spot in the courtroom, I was kind of up against the wall looking at them from the side, so I couldn't see all of them. So when they were choosing the alternates, I wasn't sure who the alternates even were, because it's a good-sized courtroom, and the other end of the bench, you know, on the aisle, they could see the jury better than I could. So I'm not the best source of that information right now. They seemed, you know, when I saw them first thing this morning, and then as they were shuffling out, they seemed okay. They seemed normal, as they have been. It's been a long trial. And I think this is the fifth week of testimony. So they've been in here for a long time. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if they're kind of ready for this to move on to the next chapter.
But no sniffling or anything that you could
detect? Not that I could see. Not that I could see.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anybody. I've been kind of busy. This wrapped up. They got the case at 12:34. And we have a 4 o'clock live shot. And, you know, all the
mechanics.
You're busy. Get the story on the air. I didn't really get a lot of time to compare notes with some of the other reporters of what they saw. So,
well, which is why I'm so appreciative that you grab these moments to talk to me, because I know you're under deadline right now. And so I won't keep you, but I do want to ask you about those final words that the prosecutor uttered. I couldn't believe it. I thought, how brilliant, but also totally unfair. You know, to a moral certainty that she's guilty. Yeah, it's a very different metric, though, than reasonable doubt. And yet you let that linger in their gut, the moral certainty. How do you think that landed?
You know, I think it's giving them a lot to think about here. You know, there, as we simmer over these facts of what happened that day, I think people don't like to think about this because of how awful it is. But when you start paring it down to the granular level of what happened that day, when she started searching for the distance to the restaurant, when the CVS search was added into the mix to send Patrick out, the phone call that came back, it starts looking like something other than I heard a voice and I immediately acted. And she only had, they're saying, there was one expert that said it took 18 minutes to do this, to kill the children. And that would be the moment Patrick left and before he made the phone call. I haven't looked at the timeline, but it kind of fits in there. And the expert talked, now a caveat, he talked to Lindsay this year, so 3 years after the fact. But that expert was saying, giving us the 18-minute figure. And I could only think that that number must come from Lindsay Clancy herself. So 18 minutes, Patrick calls. And then after the phone call is done, she runs upstairs and attempts to kill herself. So, you know, that whole thing where it kind of slows down the events of the 24th of January in that hour, I think is, and that's when you have to start looking at, well, was there premeditation? Did she understand that this was wrong? The moral question that you asked, that's when all that starts coming into play. So, you know, we can't tell, you know, if it was a quick verdict, you know, if we get a verdict tomorrow, I would have to say there, you know, she's going to prison. Wow. The longer it takes, I think it's, you know, that's when they're trying to figure all this stuff out, trying to untangle it, just like we are.
It's funny how you said that, because I thought, for me, I was thinking if they get a quick verdict, they're with the ladies in pink. And they're thinking, no. There's no way that this woman, you know, the way I'm looking at her across the way, she was out of it. I could imagine them doing a quick verdict that way, too.
I could if I saw them with different expressions on their faces every day. So I'm just going off a gut thing. You know, they come into the courtroom. Some of them, they don't even look her way. Some of them do, but not all of them. And I have to think those are the ones that are, you know, predisposed to not letting her go. And they are all taking it very seriously. I don't see, you know, we saw the girl in the green dress the other day. The jury is not like that. They're all business. And they do look around at us to see, you know, sometimes they want to see who's in the courtroom, but they're paying attention. They had notebooks and they filled those notebooks. So, you know, I think they're going to go through this, you know, thoroughly. But I do think that if it's a quick verdict, I don't think that's going to be good for Lindsay Clancy. But
speaking of the,
you know, what do I know?
I know we're all through reading the tea leaves after OJ.
Exactly.
You mentioned the girl in the green dress, and I do want to bring that up because I do think it's interesting, and also, it's helpful for people to understand that when someone, and if you haven't seen it, folks, we'll show you the pictures. This the camera was sweeping across the front bench of the courtroom, and it caught this woman in a green dress, almost like, you know, vibing and posing for the camera and then smiling and winking. And the story came out that she had been working for Vanity Fair, or she was going to write something for Vanity Fair. There's some discrepancy. She says she wasn't credentialed by them or didn't have a contract with them. But in any case, Vanity Fair said, we've let her go and we're not going to work with her. But I want a bigger question. There is, she is the only one with that kind of a vibe, right? Everything else has been just extraordinarily somber and sad.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. I mean, the world's media seems to be here. If I could, I'm outside the courthouse right now, and I got here, court opened at 8:30. I was in line around 7:15, and I was already, it was like being at Disney World trying to get on Space Mountain. That's how long that line was. And so there's a lot of media here, and she was here for a while. I didn't really get to know her, but I'm in that picture. I'm right behind her. And I didn't even know the courtroom camera was turning around to shoot us in the crowd. So, it's unfortunate, you know, I think there was just a lack of awareness of where you are. That shot was probably taken either when the jury is leaving or coming in, probably leaving at the end of the day. And, you know, it appears to me she let her guard down, and it's unfortunate. It's a lesson. If she stays in this business, it's a lesson she'll never forget.
And it's a lesson for everyone else. Bob, I remember as a Cub reporter 40 years ago, 38, give or take, I got chewed out by a judge in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, Cub reporter just starting out. And I was chewing Dentine because it was morning and I just thought I had a yucky breath, but I wasn't snapping my gum. I was just chewing it quietly. And I was three quarters of the way back in a giant courtroom, and he singled me out and said, there is no chewing gum in my courtroom. Oh, I was mortified, and I never did it again. But it does. Yeah. I mean, you do need to be chastened. You do need to hear of the chastenings to realize how serious courtrooms are. Bob, I know you got to go, but come back again, please. And good luck with the rest of your deadline.
Thank you. All right. Talk to you later.
Obviously, we are going to be watching every second of the verdict watch, and I am going to deliver you that verdict as soon as it comes. And I think we're all kind of hanging on pins and needles here, wondering, what are they going to do? What's reasonable for them? I'm Ashley Banfield. Thanks so much for listening, for watching, for subscribing. And remember, truth isn't just serious, it's drop dead serious.